sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today was originally broadcast in March of 2011. And here it is. Today you're going to hear about what Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Bush were doing on the morning of 9/11. That will be followed by some 9/11 news updates, and then I'll briefly touch on another controlled demolition, the bailout scam. So let's begin with the whereabouts of our three top leaders on 9/11. This segment comes from the website The Corbett Report, and it's called The Three Amigos, and here it is.
As Secretary of Defense from 2001 to 2006, Donald Rumsfeld was the head of the U.S. Department of Defense and the chief policy advisor to President Bush, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military. Donald Rumsfeld was the man at the helm of the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, the date of the first attack on U.S. home soil since Pearl Harbor, and arguably the most important day in U.S. military operations in modern history. With the commander-in-chief otherwise occupied on that fateful morning, Donald Rumsfeld was effectively the highest-ranking civilian in the U.S. military in Washington. So where was Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on the morning of 9/11?
Secretary Rumsfeld was in his suite of offices on the other side of the building from the impact zone. He felt it, and he immediately was on the attack site within moments, much to the displeasure of his security people, but he did it. And there are pictures of the secretary helping other men carry stretchers of the injured.
What such Hollywood-esque hyperbole fails to denote is that Rumsfeld was, for all intents and purposes, missing in action on that morning until the Pentagon was struck. Rumsfeld told CNN's Larry King on December 5, 2001, that he was in fact addressing a congressional delegation on the certainty of a terrorist attack in the very near future at 8 a.m. on September 11th as the first plane hit the World Trade Center. By his own admission, after the meeting was adjourned, Rumsfeld went in to get his regular CIA briefing, which was already scheduled for 9:30. For half an hour, Rumsfeld waited in his office because he wanted to make a few phone calls. The CIA briefing started as regularly scheduled at 9:30 a.m., and 7 minutes later, the Pentagon was struck. What was Rumsfeld doing for that half hour between his adjourned congressional briefing and his CIA briefing? The question is by no means trivial. On June 1, 2001, just 3 months before 9/11, the Department of Defense's protocols for dealing with hijacked civil aircraft were changed. These changes made it explicit that all requests by the National Military Command Center for assistance by the Department of Defense in the event of a hijacking required the approval of the Secretary of Defense. Why were the protocols for dealing with terrorist hijackings changed just 3 months before 9/11 to specifically indicate that all requests for assistance by the Department of Defense had to be cleared with the Secretary of Defense? And how did Rumsfeld going AWOL on the morning of the most important attacks in modern U.S. military history affect the response of NORAD that day? These are the questions that the 9/11 Commission just didn't ask. And if the Secretary of Defense was AWOL, who was running the Emergency Operations Center that morning? Donald Rumsfeld was the head of the Department of Defense from 2001 to 2006. and the man who was to be contacted specifically in the event of a terrorist hijacking, according to the DOD's own guidelines, which were mysteriously revised just months prior to 9/11. However, as we exposed in a previous documentary, Rumsfeld was missing in action on this, the most important day of his career. So if we are to accept at face value that the head of the US military was so out of the loop that morning that he was not even aware of the hijacked jet flying over Washington until it hit the very building that he was sitting in, then just who was in charge of emergency operations that morning?
A call to the traveling president, urgent conversations with top aides, and then a burst through the door.
My agent all of a sudden materialized beside me and said, "Sir, we have to leave now," and grabbed me and propelled me out of my office and down the hall into the underground shelter in the White House.
In White House shorthand, it is the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center.
Oh, I didn't know that it existed till I was actually down there, and I'm not sure I could find my way back there to this day.
A Cold War relic deep underground, and the Vice President's base of operations on the first day of a new war.
In the 9/11 Commission's final report, Cheney's time of arrival at the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, is given as 9:58 a.m. This is directly contradicted, however, by testimony given before the 9/11 Commission by Norman Mineta, who was the Secretary of Transportation at the time. Norman Mineta testified that Cheney was already at the PEOC at 9:20 a.m. when he arrived, but the 9/11 Commission report lists the time of Cheney's arrival as 9:58. Where did the 9/11 Commission get this number, and why is this discrepancy important? If we are to believe the 9/11 Commission report, Cheney didn't arrive until after Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. If Mineta is right, however, Cheney was commanding the Emergency Operations Center as the plane was bearing down on the heart of the American capital, the most heavily defended airspace in the world. This is not a trivial point. Nor is it merely a case of Norman Mineta being confused about the timing of events that day. In fact, he remembers quite clearly exactly what Cheney was doing as the plane approached.
During the time that the airplane coming in to the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, the plane is 50 miles out, the plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the Vice President, "Do the orders still stand?" And the Vice President turned and whipped his neck around and said, "Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?"
A moment's contemplation reveals the magnitude of what we have just heard. Not only was Cheney in the PEOC before Flight 77 hit, he told an obviously nervous aide that the orders still stood and then listened as the plane approached and then hit the Pentagon, the most heavily defended building in the world. Did we just hear confirmation that there was indeed a stand-down order that morning? That is, an order to, in effect, let the plane hit the Pentagon. As the job of creating an informed public has been abdicated by the controlled corporate media, the job of following up with Mr. Mineta about his bombshell information has fallen to the public itself. So far, We Are Change, a citizen activist group known for asking the questions that the controlled corporate media just won't ask, has been the only journalist group to follow up with Mineta about his testimony.
My main concern is that in your testimony, you stated that Vice President Dick Cheney came into the PEOC office at 9:20 when you arrived, and he was already there. He's gone in front of Meet the Press, and he said that he was there at 9:38. If you got a chance to read it, but it puts him half an hour later. So I don't mean to ask a rhetorical question, but to the best of your recollection, was Vice President Dick Cheney already there at 9:20 when you arrived?
Yeah, I might have been mistaken on the 9:25, but he was already there.
At
but I,
It wasn't 9:58. Yeah, that puts them 38 minutes later, which does not make sense to us at all.
No, I don't know how that comes about.
So, and I mean, it goes against your testimony, and it goes against his own testimony. I mean, the press, where he said he was there at 9:38, that's a full 38 minutes. So, to the best of your recollection, he was already there.
Oh, absolutely.
Why has the corporate-controlled media never followed up with either Cheney or Mineta about this discrepancy, key to our understanding of what happened on that day? Why did the 9/11 Commission report list the time of Cheney's arrival at the PEOC as 9:58 a.m.? And can Cheney himself ever be trusted to set the record straight for the American people?
It's good to be back at the Council on Foreign Relations. As Pete mentioned, I've been a member for a long time and was actually a director for some period of time. I never mentioned that when I was campaigning for re-election back home in Wyoming.
The inevitable question now becomes, if Rumsfeld was missing in action, and Cheney was sitting in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, listening to Flight 77 approaching and then hitting the Pentagon, what was the Commander-in-Chief doing on that day? When asked by a student what he was thinking on 9/11, President Bush gave this answer.
How did you feel when you heard about the terrorist attack?
Well, Gordon, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on. I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it.
This, of course, is impossible. The only footage of the first plane hitting Tower 1 in the immediate aftermath of the attacks came from the Naudé brothers, who were filming a documentary about New York firefighters that day. Their footage was not being broadcast live, and was not aired on television until much later. President Bush's story, then, is likely completely made up, designed to make him look like a decisive leader who was kept up to the minute on what was happening, and continually assessing the information he was presented with. If this is indeed a lie, then what is the truth about what Bush was thinking on 9/11? Was he at this point contemplating the fact that his life was in very real danger? Consider that as the second plane hits the World Trade Center and Bush is told America is under attack, his Secret Service detail do absolutely nothing to remove him from this unsecured public location, despite the fact that his itinerary had been publicly available in advance. He was a sitting duck, and yet he was allowed to stay there for 20 minutes before leaving aboard Air Force One. What was his Secret Service detail thinking? What caused them to disregard all of their own protocols and all of their training? This is the very situation that they had been training for all of their career, yet they leave the president here in this public, undefended location. Contrast this with Vice President Cheney, who as soon as the attack started was physically picked up and carried to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center by his Secret Service detail.
A call to the traveling president, urgent conversations with top aides, and then a burst through the door.
My agent all of a sudden materialized beside me and said, sir, we have to leave now. And he grabbed me and propelled me out of my office and down the hall into the underground shelter in the White House.
Perhaps if Bush was thinking clearly at this point, he'd be remembering how Kennedy was also stripped of his Secret Service protection right before he was killed. Or perhaps he was thinking of the strange early morning visit he had received at the Colony Beach and Tennis Resort in Longboat Key, Florida, where he had been staying the previous evening. The Longboat Observer noted that on the morning of September 11th, at 6 a.m., a van occupied by Middle Eastern men pulled up to the resort and asked to speak to a Secret Service agent by name, claiming to have an appointment for a poolside interview with the president. As no such interview was on the president's itinerary, the men were turned away. This came just 2 days after the assassination of General Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of Afghanistan's Northern Alliance, by a pair of Al-Qaeda agents posing as Moroccan journalists, who had hidden an explosive in their camera, which detonated during the interview, thus killing Massoud. Was this van full of Middle Eastern men at the Longboat Key Resort planning something similar with President Bush? Was this another indication that the president's life was in danger that morning? Regardless of whether or not President Bush was aware of these threats to his life that morning, he was about to be made aware of one very specific threat concerning Air Force One. This threat was taken quite seriously at the time, because as researcher Webster Tarpley notes, it was preceded by some very important code words.
And then above all, the centerpiece of 9/11, I think the single most important piece of evidence in the entire day, the incoming threat given to the Secret Service, Angel is next, meaning we will destroy Air Force One. And it doesn't just come with Angel is next, it then comes with a train of cosmic level code words, top secret code words, indicating that behind that threat is a network that has access to the most important secrets of a whole range of executive departments, presumably CIA, National Security Agency, Pentagon, FBI, Justice, Treasury even, the whole array. And that's a threat. The idea is, what they're saying to Bush is, you've got to go on television and start saying, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, 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 and you will remain in office. If you don't, you may be liquidated at any time. You may not see the end of this day. So the invisible government had to have the possibility of nuclear escalation, and they did. They had it in two ways that we know of. One is that in the Angel is Next phone call, they had code words that seemed to indicate that they had access to the nuclear launch codes, that they were able to somehow access the so-called football, the collection, the briefcases that are filled with these codes that accompany the president but are also kept in other places for use in case of all-out nuclear war. So the perpetrators of 9/11, the coup faction inside the U.S. government, have these codes. They can launch nuclear war that way. There's another way they could have launched it, through an exercise called Global Guardian, because it just so happened that on the morning of 9/11 there was also an exercise simulating all-out thermonuclear war. And part of that exercise appears to have been an attempt, as a part of the drill, as a part of the simulation, for a rogue faction to gain access to command and control systems that would give them the ability to launch missiles. So that might be the concrete, specific backdoor that the invisible government might have used in order to escalate in the nuclear realm, if that had become necessary. Essentially, the ultimatum to Bush is, either you launch the war of civilizations against the Arabs and the Islamic world in Afghanistan, later in Iraq, you launch it in conventional form, or we will launch it ourselves in nuclear form.
As Tarpley notes in his seminal work, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Bush made two very telling stops with Air Force One that morning. The first was to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, an important node in the STRATCOM war exercise known as Global Guardian, which was taking place that day. The second was Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. This just happens to be home to the Strategic Command Bunker, the only place from which the Commander-in-Chief can personally override any nuclear launch command. Also at Offutt Air Force Base that day was Warren Buffett, who was hosting a charity event for presidents, CEOs, and other captains of industry, who on any other given day would have been at their offices, many of them at the World Trade Center. This information comes from Ann Tatlock, CEO of Fiduciary Trust, who on that morning was attending Buffett's event and watched as the second plane crashed into her own office. Why is Bush's stop at the Strategic Command Bunker at Office Air Force Base? And the coincidental presence there of Warren Buffett and many of the presidents and CEOs of the businesses destroyed that day, not talked about in the controlled corporate media.
What you just heard was produced by the Corbett Report and was called The Three Amigos. You can Google the Corbett Report to hear that and more on 9/11 and the related issues. And now for some 9/11 updates. There's a new website out called Lawyers for 9/11 Truth. And here's what it says on their website. Lawyers are trained to value the Constitution and the rule of law. We are trained to examine evidence and to spot cover-ups or inconsistencies in the evidence and bias in witnesses or decision-makers. Attorneys are also experts in weighing conflicting evidence. For all of the above reasons, we are demanding an end to the 9/11 cover-up and a full investigation by unbiased people with subpoena power and the courage to demand that the Constitution and rule of law are followed and all guilty persons held accountable for their actions. The following legal scholars, judges, and attorneys demand an end to the 9/11 cover-up, a new, full, and unbiased investigation, and punishment of all guilty parties. You can check out their website by going to www.lawyersfor911truth.blogspot.com. And you can also email them at the following address, email@l911t.com. Also in 9/11 news, architect Richard Gage is currently touring Europe. People were turned away for lack of room in both Madrid and Paris. Richard Gage continues his tour of Europe this week. And now for the bailout scam. I want to give you a website that I highly recommend if you'd like to learn more about the economic situation that we find ourselves in, along with some other issues. The website is www.chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. He offers a crash course that I highly recommend you take. And now, just for the record, for those of you who don't already know, I just want to mention that the Federal Reserve is not owned by our government. It's a privately owned bank, and it has been that way since 1913. And now I'm going to read you an article that appeared on 911blogger.com on November 17th, 2008, and was written by George Washington. And the title is Erocking the American Economy. The American economy hasn't just been wrecked, it's been Iraqed. As Senator Inhofe said Saturday, it is just outrageous that the American people don't know that Congress doesn't know how much money he, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, has given away to anyone, the Oklahoma Republican told the Tulsa World. It could be to his friends, it could be to anybody else. We don't know. There is no way of knowing. Bloomberg concurs, writing that the Federal Reserve has failed to comply with congressional demands for transparency and disclose the destination of at least $2 trillion. Sound familiar? Remember the missing billions of dollars which were earmarked for rebuilding Iraq but have gone missing? Naomi Klein points out that the guy initially chosen to serve as chief investment officer for the bailout program previously served as executive director of Paul Bremer's infamous Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad during the early days of the Iraq War. Part of his job was to hire civilian staff, which made him an integral part of the partisan machine that filled the green zone with young Republicans, investment bankers, and Dick Cheney interns. Qualifications weren't a big issue back then because the staff's main function was to hand over stacks of taxpayer money to private contractors, who were the ones actually running the occupation. It was this nonstop cash conveyor belt that earned the Green Zone a reputation, in the words of one CPA official, as a free fraud zone. During Senate hearings last year, when the proposed head of the bailout program was asked what he had learned from his experience at the CPA, he said he thought that contracts should be handed out with more speed and flexibility, the same philosophy he cited back when he was in charge of regulating Wall Street traders. Inhofe also pointed out the parallels between the bailout and the Iraq War. He said, I have learned a long time ago, when they come up and say this has to be done and it has to be done immediately, there's no other way of doing it, you have to sit back and take a deep breath. And 9 times out of 10, they're not telling the truth, he said. And this is one of those nine times. Congress abdicated its constitutional responsibilities by signing a truly blank check over to the Treasury Secretary, he wrote. The powers that be scared Congress with doomsday scenarios of Saddam helping al-Qaeda build a nuclear bomb so that Congress wrote a blank check. Then the taxpayers' money disappeared without a paper trail or oversight into the pockets of the well-connected. The exact same thing is happening with the bailout. They're not only wrecking the American economy, they're erocking it. The same thing happened with 9/11 as well. Congress was terrified into signing an anti-American Patriot Act because it was told that otherwise al-Qaeda was going to get us. But instead of actually taking steps to increase the national security of the U.S., the Patriot Act has been used as a cash cow for security consulting firms, as well as those hostile to the Constitution. And now I want to alert you to another idea that's being discussed in Washington. This comes from an article from the website newswithviews.com and was written by Devi on November 13th, 2008. And the title is Unprecedented Rape of the American People Underway in D.C. And I don't agree with everything in this article. It's a six-page article. But this part that I'm going to read you I think is important, and I have read it in other sources also. So here goes. Democrats in the U.S. House have been conducting hearings on proposals to confiscate workers' personal retirement accounts, including 401ks and IRAs, and convert them to accounts managed by the Social Security Administration. Triggered by the financial crisis the past 2 months, the hearings reportedly were meant to stem losses incurred by many workers and retirees whose 401k and IRA balances have been shrinking rapidly. The testimony of Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economic policy analysis at the New School of Social Research in New York, in hearings October 7th, drew the most attention and criticism. Testifying before the House Committee on Education and Labor, Ghilarducci proposed that the government eliminate tax breaks for 401k and similar retirement accounts, such as IRAs, and confiscate workers' retirement plan accounts and convert them to universal guaranteed retirement accounts managed by the Social Security Administration. Social Security is a tax that goes into the general fund of the Treasury and is not earmarked for any specific spending purpose. That is a fact. To even suggest that the $1 trillion in retirement funds be transferred over to a government who can't balance a budget and continues to write hot checks for hundreds of billions of dollars every day of the week is the ultimate in lunacy. Tens of millions of Americans are depending on these retirement accounts to be ready when they retire. I cannot even put into words what will be the end result if such a dastardly deed is done by Congress. So, Washington appears to be out of control. Are we the frogs sitting in the slowly warming waters? I know many of you have your hopes set on Obama, but remember, he voted for the bailout package and encouraged others to do so too. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.